You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. With a presidential election just over a year away, the future of Wisconsin's election administrator is on shaky ground. A state Senate committee held a public hearing on Megan Wolf's potential reappointment earlier this week, though the full Senate would need to vote on confirming her. Or maybe not. State Attorney General Josh Call has argued that going forward with any further action on her position at this point is actually illegal. You could join in at 800-642-1234. A lot of twists and turns to untangle here. Have you been following this story? What questions do you have? Do you work as an election official in Wisconsin? How is all of this affecting you? Do you think we need a change in the top elections job here in the state? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Molly Beck starts us off, senior capital reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel covering Wisconsin politics and state government. Molly, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, before we dive into the tangles here, a quick reminder, Megan Wolf, talk about the job she does and how important it is, say, for an election year like 2024.
Yeah, Megan Wolf, she oversees the Wisconsin Elections Commission, which is basically Wisconsin's statewide elections agency. She handles all of the bipartisan commission's directives for election clerks, and which means, you know, they set some rules on how elections can be run in conjunction with the law. They kind of carry out what the election law is with different rules that are kind of at a very base level that lawmakers don't get into the weeds that way. So the commission takes it a step further and says, this is, you know, this is how we should do things.
And now
she's charged with carrying out the commissioner's wishes.
And now we've got her term technically coming to an end. The elections commission holds a vote related to her reappointment, and then it gets weird. Talk us through what happened.
Yeah, so her term expired at the end of June, but I'm not sure if your listeners remember, but there was a Supreme Court ruling that was it was in a lawsuit filed over the former DNR board chairman who refused to leave his post after his term expired. The Supreme Court said it was okay for him to do that. So the Democratic commissioners on the Bipartisan Elections Commission decided to abstain from voting on her reappointment in an effort to A, keep her in her job, because there is a side effort in the Senate among Republican lawmakers to remove her. And that is all based on concerns in the Republican base over the 2020 election that they are attributing to her. So the Democratic commissioners are using this Supreme Court ruling as their basis to say there is no vacancy. The Supreme Court has said that, you know, the only reason for somebody in that kind of a position to leave is if they are removed or if they die, and there's no vacancy to reappoint her to. Republicans in the state Senate disagree with that. They moved forward with her her reappointment, even though there was no reappointment that the commission voted on. So that's the very complicated situation we're in right now.
And so the Senate is going ahead with this thing. We've got the state attorney general saying, no, you can't do that. A legislative legislative legal analysis says you probably can't do that. But we have a hearing on Tuesday. What happened at that hearing? Who did we hear from?
Yeah, so the Senate Elections Committee held a hearing on her reappointment, even though the reappointment is up for debate. And there were a lot of people that, if you were following the news in 2021, when former Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman was hired by the Assembly to investigate the 2020 election, you know, a lot of people who were affiliated with that review that ended up not finding any evidence of widespread election fraud or that the election was incorrectly called. A lot of the allegations that were put forward by Gableman, you know, he did not put any evidence forward to substantiate them. Nevertheless, that line of thinking among a group of the Republican base, not the entire base, but a very vocal portion of the base believes that the 2020 election, Donald Trump won the 2020 election in Wisconsin. And there were a lot of people at this hearing that were talking about that and blaming Megan Wolf for decisions that they believe, you know, led to an incorrect election outcome in Wisconsin, even though there have been lawsuits and audits and, you know, nonpartisan reviews and recounts paid for by Donald Trump to that, you know, confirm Joe Biden's win in Wisconsin in 2020.
Talking to Molly Beck from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about Wisconsin's top election official and a possible attempt to remove her. Debates over whether that attempt is valid. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Molly, one voice not heard at this hearing about Megan Wolf's role was Megan Wolf. What do we know about her decision not to appear at this hearing?
Yeah, I mean, there was a elections commission here meeting just before this hearing was set to take place, and the Republican chairman of the commission put forward a motion to give her direction on whether to go or not. And that motion ended up being retracted and they didn't give her any advice. But during that meeting, she said that she felt like she was in a very untenable position because she doesn't want to attend the hearing if the commission doesn't want her to, you know, which is, you know, what, you know, if they had given her direction, she would have had an idea of what to do. But after the Attorney General Josh Call put out a memo later on that said, you know, because of this recent Supreme Court ruling, there is no vacancy. And what the Senate is doing, they're taking up a reappointment that doesn't exist, essentially. So right after that, that letter was put out publicly, she said she was deciding not to go. The commissioners don't, you know, there are Republican commissioners and Democratic commissioners. The Democratic commissioners said they didn't want her to go because they didn't believe the hearing would be fair to her. The Republican chairman said it probably wouldn't be fair to her, but she is the best person to defend herself and defend the commission and explain exactly what the commission does because she is an expert in the field. So, but ultimately, she decided not to go.
So we've got Republicans in the Senate. They took the step of having this committee hearing. Do we have a sense of what's next from Republican leadership in the Senate on pursuing this?
No. The Senate Majority Leader, Devin LeMahieu, he's the leader of the Senate. He has not answered many questions from the Journal Sentinel, at least, about what's next or about the legal analysis that the legislature's own attorneys put out last week. I wrote a story about saying that, you know, for the Senate to take up a reappointment, her reappointment would require four votes of the Elections Commission, and she did not get that. So that conflicts with the Senate leader's explanation of why they're moving forward with this. He has not answered any questions about that or what's next. We also asked the Senate Elections Committee Chairman Dan Knodel whether he would schedule a committee vote on her reappointment, and he said he wasn't sure.
And if, just briefly, Molly, if the Senate goes ahead with this as though they have the authority, votes to remove Megan Wolf from the position, I'm guessing we'll see lots of lawsuits on her behalf.
Oh, yeah.
have people already put their chips on the table on that one?
That's pretty much the only thing anyone agrees on in the situation. This is heading to court.
Molly, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Molly Beck, senior capital reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked to her today about this week's hearing on the status of Megan Wolf's position on the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Coming up, an expert on Wisconsin politics joins in, and you can join in too at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how all this works? What could happen the longer that Megan Wolf's job, the top election job, hangs in the balance? How do you want to see this resolved? Do you want to see a change in leadership at the top of Wisconsin's election administration? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about Megan Wolf and her future as administrator for the Wisconsin Elections Commission, how the situation is playing out politically in the state legislature and legally. You can join in at 800-642-1234. David Cannon joins us now, professor emeritus in the UW-Madison Department of Political Science. He's researched election administration and reform, and he's the author of the book Race, Redistricting, and Representation. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you, Rob.
A complicated story here, David. What do you think of this flu-for-all about the state's top election job?
It really has been quite remarkable. And Molly did a very nice job of summarizing the key background in terms of how this is all unfolded. But I wanted to emphasize one additional point just for some more background here. There are really sort of two sets of questions here. One's the procedural side, and one's the more substantive side. And Molly summarized very nicely the procedural question, which is there really a vacancy here the Senate can even be voting on? The Attorney General says no. The Legislative Council says no. The State Senate's going ahead. So that's the first point that I think was covered nicely already. But the second, on the substance side, mm-hmm. I think it's really important to emphasize the point that, again, that Molly brought up, that Megan Wolf is not making independent decisions here. She's carrying out the wishes of the commission, the bipartisan commission with six commissioners. And on the specifics of what the Senate Republicans are upset about has to do with the conduct of the 2020 election on things like the use of drop boxes, ballot curing, that where the election clerks were adding the witnesses' addresses. If the witness address was missing, that would cause an absentee ballot to be thrown out. Well, clerks were actually adding in those addresses, according to the guidance from the Election Commission and from Megan Wolf. And then also the nursing homes, where there were ballots sent to nursing homes rather than the voting deputies that normally would go there. Well, the thing is, on each one of those points, with the nursing homes, for example, in March 2020, there was a 6-0 vote by the commissioners. So a unanimous vote with all the three Republicans and the three Democratic commissioners all agreeing that, yeah, we want the people in nursing homes to be able to vote. COVID's going on. No one's being allowed into nursing homes. The voting deputies can't go in there. And so that was a 6-0 vote. And then there were some subsequent votes that were 5-1. And then on the ballot curing, that was first put in place back in 2016, again by a unanimous 6-0 vote, and had been used in 11 statewide elections, through 2020, and no one ever complained about that before. And so these are things that after the fact, with sort of Trump partisans, saying the election was stolen, looking at things evidence did come out from some of the nursing home voting that there were some people who had voted that should not have voted in nursing homes, but just a handful of votes that didn't affect the outcome of the election. But they're focusing in on things like that and blaming Megan Wolf for this, when in fact she's just carrying out, in those cases, the unanimous 6-0 decisions by the commissioners.
What do you think it would take to get back to, in Congress, they call it regular order, doing these things in the routine way we'd expect them to?
Well, that's a really good question. If I knew the answer to that, things have gotten so bad right now. And people have used the term like, scorched earth politics. And it's kind of what we're seeing right now. It's just hard to know how we can unwind this to get back to the way things were, where, going back to 2016, things like, filling in witness addresses from the public record to allow someone to vote, that was a bipartisan, let's make sure, people can vote. And now it's just become so polarized that the very act of trying to administer elections is incredibly controversial. There's no easy answer to that in terms of how we can unwind this and get back to where we were.
Talking to David Cannon from the UW-Madison Department of Political Science, looking at the state's election commission, the administrator there, argument in the Senate over whether to keep her on, arguments about whether they have a choice the way things have played out. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. We've got Steve in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I think the guest is being a little disingenuous. Megan is in charge of the swamp. The swamp presents information to the folks that vote on it. And it was pretty obvious in the 2016 election, the Democrats blamed Jill Stein and the Green Party for diverting votes away from the Democratic Party. And they made it their effort to get the Green Party off the ballot in 2020. They made that publicly clear. And they did that using Megan Wolf and her providing information to those people that voted to keep the Green Party off the ballot. That's one of the main reasons why Trump lost in Wisconsin, as well as a variety of states. Additionally, Democracy in the Park, which was proven to be illegal by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, Megan Wolf is the person in charge of the swamp that presented the information to these people to vote.
Steve, thanks for the call. Yeah, the Green Party was left off the ballot after the Elections Commission vote over one of the candidates listing two different addresses. The state Supreme Court ended up backing that up 4-3. But David, to Steve's point, Megan Wolf, he says, steered the Elections Commission wrong.
Well, I mean, Steve's right that, you know, she does have a fair amount of agenda setting ability in terms of how issues get presented to the commission. But ultimately, it is their decision that's being made. And on the point of Democracy in the Park, actually, it's a good example, I think, of how this has all become so politicized in terms of looking back at the election of 2020, seeing something that's controversial now that we didn't see as controversial then. In the letter from the attorney for Robin Voss and the state Senate Majority Leader at the time, Scott Fitzgerald, complaining about Democracy in the Park, in that very letter, they endorse the idea of drop boxes. They say that, you know, Democracy in the Park is bad, but in the letter they say further, voters may also deposit their completed absentee ballots in authorized drop boxes. We wholeheartedly support the voters' use of these convenient, secure, and expressly authorized absentee ballot return methods. And this is written on behalf of Robin Voss and Scott Fitzgerald. And so this is in September of 2020, like right before the election, saying that drop boxes are the preferred method of voting. And yet after the election, all of a sudden drop boxes become one of the targets of how Megan Wolf led the commission astray. But shortly before the election, this again was not a partisan thing.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Ron joins us now in Manitowoc. Ron, hi.
Thanks, Rob. I'm wondering if the Election Commission has been a rather recent creation by the Republicans, and is there a move by the Republicans to eliminate it?
Ron, thanks for the call.
You're right. The Wisconsin Election Commission is what took the place of the previous Government Accountability Board that oversaw both ethics concerns and election issues and was actually held up as a national model of how nonpartisan election administration, you know, could be done. That was dismantled, and in its place was the Wisconsin Election Commission that has, I think, still done a very credible job of administering elections with the bipartisan commission where there are, you know, three Republicans, three Democrats on the commission. There, if they did try to dismantle it entirely, which there's been, you know, some rumors of that, there hasn't been any serious move right now to do it before 2024. I think that would be, you know, pretty impossible to do. But it's hard to know, like, what would replace it, because there are a lot of decisions that, you know, as a previous caller, Steve, put it, you know, in the swamp, where you have to make those decisions on, you know, in real time as things come up. You can't keep on going back to the state legislature to ask, you know, them to rewrite laws all the time. You always have to have administrators interpreting laws. And so that, I think, would be a bad move to get rid of the commission entirely.
Ron, thanks for the call. Nate joins us now in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. From what a lot of I've read, she's done a competent and good job. And I think this wouldn't even be an issue if you didn't have a partisan gerrymandered state Senate that seems to have a group of conspiracy theorists driving it, when basically what happened in the 2020 election is that people who were legitimate Wisconsin citizens were able to cast their ballots and get those ballots counted as they should have been.
Nate, thanks for the call. David?
Yeah, I mean, there, as I think, you know, Molly pointed out in the introductory part, that there are, you know, people in the Senate who were claiming at the hearing on Tuesday that Donald Trump did actually win the election in 2020. But every investigation, including the Michael Gableman investigation, the 14-month, $1.1 million investigation, you know, showed that there wasn't systematic fraud. They pointed to several concerns like the nursing home voting and the grants from Mark Zuckerberg and some other issues that they were upset about, but nothing that was at the level of what would have changed the outcome of the election. So I think that probably is at the root of why some people want to get rid of Megan Wolf, is they want to have someone to blame for what they see as an illegitimate election.
Nate, thanks for the call. And David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Okay, it's good to be with you.
That's David Cannon, Professor Emeritus in the UW-Madison Department of Political Science. We talked to them about the politics around the future of Wisconsin Election Administrator Megan Wolf as Wisconsin gets ready for another big election in 2024. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, a new book tells the often overlooked story of the theft of Native American lands in Wisconsin and in the Midwest. Explore that history with the author of Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. And from mining frozen ponds to a freezer in almost every home, the way we've used ice has changed a lot over the years. We'll learn more with the author of the new book, Ice, from mixed drinks to skating rinks, a cool history of a hot commodity. That includes a stop in Milwaukee for some hardball ice business. A lot of great stories and anecdotes in the book, and unusual history of a pretty common product nowadays. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we take a look at Oregon's Measure 110, the only law of its kind in the nation which decriminalizes all drugs and instead focuses on public health. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Communities around the U.S. and countries around the world are reconsidering their policies on addictive drugs. Here in the U.S., there's been a lot of attention lately to a law in Oregon from 2021. It's called Measure 110. It decriminalized possession of small amounts of all drugs, changing the punishment to a fine. Only those with larger quantities of drugs are prosecuted. Oregon has some of the highest rates of substance abuse in the nation, according to federal surveys, and access to treatment hasn't kept pace. There's been backlash against the measure in Oregon as people cite incidents of public drug use in Portland and elsewhere and an increase in overdose deaths. But it can be hard to sort out the effects of decriminalization as overdose deaths went up in communities all over the country, not just Oregon. We're taking a look at the only state in the country to decriminalize all drugs and what lessons we might be able to take from that policy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on decriminalizing drug use and focusing on treatment instead? Do you think something like that would work in Wisconsin? Do you want to see some drugs decriminalized, not others? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Alex Kreit is the director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy and an assistant professor at the Northern Kentucky University School of Law. Alex, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit more about this Measure 110 in the state of Oregon? What does it do? What were the intentions behind it?
Yeah, so this was passed through a ballot measure in 2020. And the idea really was to take, you know, a true public health approach, to attempt to take a true public health approach to substance use and addiction, substance use disorder. And it was modeled after similar measures in other countries, including most notably in Portugal. And what it does, it basically decriminalizes a possession of personal use amounts of all previously illegal drugs. And so if you have a personal use amount of drugs in Oregon. That is not a criminal offense any longer. Instead, it's kind of like an infraction type of level thing where you would get a $100 traffic ticket type of fine, and that traffic ticket can be waived if the person who receives it calls a treatment referral number and agrees to participate in a treatment needs assessment. Now, of course, that's just for smaller personal use amounts. Possession of non-personal use amounts is a misdemeanor. And then, of course, the drug sales, manufacture, those kinds of offenses remain, you know, as they had been.
There's been backlash in the media and elsewhere this year, people pointing toward complaints about public drug use, rising rates of addiction, concerns about overdose deaths. That could be because of decriminalization, but similar things are happening in other states around the country. How do you try to tease out what this decriminalization measure has actually done over the last couple of years?
Yeah, I think it really is still too early to know and try to untangle what the overall effect of Measure 110, and that's the number of that ballot measure, has been in Oregon. Because, and it's been a little unfortunate to see in past couple of weeks or so, some news stories and kind of, I think, trying to maybe politicize it a bit or trying to jump to early conclusions, because, you know, there have been certainly an increase in overdose deaths in Oregon since 2019, but that's true nationwide. I think there's been something like a 94% increase across the country of overdose deaths between 2019 and 2021. And Oregon still has a lower overdose death rate than the national average. I think theirs is like 25 per 100,000, and the national average is 34 per 100,000. So, you know, it's a situation where you could point to, do a profile of Portland and point to a lot of problems that have been increasing there in the past couple of years around homelessness, disorderly behavior, overdose deaths. But that same profile could be written about a number of other cities, unfortunately, in the United States. I'm recalling the New York Times had a profile of Phoenix, Arizona, and a homelessness encampment there a few months back that painted a kind of similar picture to some of the profiles of Portland. So it's really difficult to say. I mean, we do know, certainly with respect to 110, some measurables. We know that arrests for possession have fallen substantially. I think it was by 83% in 2021. We know that that certainly saves a degree of money. I believe it was estimated that an arrest for possession in Oregon cost about $15,000 or so prior to that ballot measure. So every arrest you don't make is some money saved. We do know for sure that the state has increased its investment and its funding of harm reduction services and, to a degree, treatment services. And we know that there has been some increase in people receiving treatment services in Oregon. But again, we do also know there's been a rise in overdose deaths. There's certainly been an increase in homelessness in Portland and public reports of public use, incidents of public use. So, I think we have, what to my mind is a little bit of an unclear situation about what the overall impact of 110 is the circumstance in Oregon.
Talking to Alex Kreit with the Chase Center on Addiction Law and Policy at Northern Kentucky University, looking at decriminalization of drugs, an experiment going on right now in the state of Oregon and in countries like Portugal. What lessons can we learn? What can't we learn? Want to know what you think or what questions you have at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Alex, you mentioned a couple phrases there that I wanted to dig more into. One part of this ballot measure, I was hoping to replace some of that criminal justice spending with harm reduction investment. What do we mean when we talk about harm reduction as a public policy?
Yeah, so, harm reduction measures are measures that, really kind of, it's in the name, aiming to reduce the harms associated with substance use. So there would be things like expanding access to the overdose reversal drug naloxone for opioid overdose deaths, expanding access to drug checking, equipment and drug checking availability for people. For example, drug checking would allow somebody, if they have purchased you know, what they think is cocaine, to check that to make sure that it's not tainted with fentanyl, because a lot of the overdose deaths that are occurring out there are from people who are taking what they think, you know, they purchased and they think that it's cocaine and it's actually tainted and laced with fentanyl. You get, you know, certainly overdose deaths occurring from that sort of thing. So harm reduction services are those kinds of measures that are not directly attacking or aiming to address treatment needs. Now, Measure 110 also does expand funding for treatment, but the expansion for harm reduction measures are for those kinds of things, to try to reduce the harms associated with substance use, most notably and most urgently, of course, overdose deaths.
And then on the treatment side of things, as you mentioned, the ballot measure increased funding for treatment, at least some. There's a concern, and again, this is a concern, I think, around the country, that there still isn't enough treatment available for people seeking to end addictions.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, one of the real difficulties with implementation in Oregon, I think, has really been around the fact that Oregon, before this ballot measure, was consistently among the lowest in treatment availability in the country, as far as in comparison to other states, according to the Department of Health and Human Services. And so, you know, Oregon was starting at a starting point of very low treatment availability. And this ballot measure, one of the aims of it is to try to increase that treatment availability. I think it's certainly done that to a degree, but I think there's no question that it's far below where it needs to be. And there's a lot of room for debate about the degree to which this is something where, you know, there's flaws maybe in the ballot measure in it, its contemplation of the degree of funding or the allocations of funding. But there's also, a reality that ramping up real comprehensive treatment is something that takes a lot more time and money to do than other kinds of public health measures, especially like harm reduction kinds of measures. If you want to increase access to drug checking, for example, you can purchase, you know, the drug checking strips. It's relatively easy and lower cost or lower investment to make that purchase, make those available. When you're talking about treatment, you know, especially residential treatment, you have to build the physical place or rent the physical place, set that place up. You have to hire staff on an ongoing basis. It's something that, you know, you can't kind of just snap a finger, even with money, and overnight you immediately ramp up that treatment capacity. So I think that is one of the things that, especially in the next, you know, year or two, is going to be critical to see, is how much is the money that is getting invested, you know, how much is that going to actually come to fruition for expansion of treatment capacity? Because that is something that, takes a lot longer to ramp up than other kinds of public health measures that are being funded by this ballot measure.
We're talking about Oregon's decriminalization of all drugs as it enters its third year, and lessons that other states, maybe even Wisconsin, could learn. Our guest is Alex Kreit, director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy and assistant professor at the Northern Kentucky University School of Law. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What solutions would you like to see for the problems of addiction and overdose deaths? Do you think that prosecuting people for drug use cuts down on drug use? If not, what would you like to see us do instead? What questions do you have for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about drug decriminalization with Alex Kreit, director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy and assistant professor at the Northern Kentucky University School of Law. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. This ballot measure a couple years back in Oregon decriminalized all drugs. What do you want to know about the policy, the impact it's had? What do you think of the idea? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Dan is on the line in Wisconsin. Dan, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up?
Hey, I wanted to bring up a few different things. I just happened to be eating lunch and listening to what's going on today. And, you know, it's always a curiosity to me to what's going on right now about the Oregon thing. Here's a little insight. Whenever you make anything illegal, I think that you create a commodity that people are going to buy no matter what. And whether it's drugs or even prostitution, I know it sounds radical, but it's true. And when you have this kind of thing criminalized, I don't think the people are going to be feeling that they're in a safe position if they're on drugs or if they're a prostitution to come forward for any kind of help. Because with it being criminalized, they're frightened, especially, let's say, it's an illegal immigrant person that's already confused about being here. That person won't come forward because it's decriminalized. And possibly the law might be worse than what the actual being on the drugs or being in the prostitution ring might be.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Alex, I think that's one of the core arguments about whether or not to decriminalize. We'll stick with drugs in particular. The idea that the harm of criminalization could rival, maybe even outweigh the harm of the substance itself. What do you think of Dan's point?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that goes to one of the reasons that, Measure 110, the advocates behind that, the sort of rationale for the ballot measure, and, Portugal's law, which, Measure 110 was based on, that was enacted in 2001. Part of the philosophy behind that was that criminalization keeps people of use, specifically keeps users more in the shadows, deters people from getting treatment, makes them scared to come forward and admit that they need treatment. And certainly Portugal, had a good deal of success with their decriminalization policy, with reductions in overdose deaths, reductions in new cases of HIV among drug injectors. And so, that was the thinking behind, Measure 110. And I think it is also the case with respect to thinking about sort of criminalization and whether criminalizing use, quote unquote, works. We've got a long sort of history of criminalizing drug possession and not really any data suggesting that drug criminalization or criminalizing simple possession has an effect in a reduction in substance use disorder and problems with addiction and abuse. And so that was the thinking behind Measure 110. Now, of course, so to date, Oregon hasn't seen the kinds of successes that Portugal did in its first decade of decriminalization. On the other hand, the decriminalization in Oregon took place at a time when the entire United States is going through this epidemic of substance use disorder and overdose death. And so, that makes it, I think, difficult to measure what the effect might be with Measure 110. And I think there's a, fair debate to be had. And I think it's very worthy of study to look at Measure 110 and say, is this a situation where there are differences between that Measure 110 in Portugal that lead to there having been at least so far less success, or there areas where it can be tweaked? Or is it a situation where, even though things aren't going great in Oregon, maybe they're better than they would have been in the absence of Measure 110? I think it's kind of an open question at this point.
Dan, thanks for the call. We'll go to Chris now in Menominee. Chris, hi.
Hi. So as I am very much in support of this measure in Portland, when we look at this from a standpoint of variables in have legislated this problem, we have a lot of data to draw from, roughly 100 years of trying to legislate this problem. What type of timeline do you think is really adequate to look at it, this experiment in Portland, and say
Chris,
that...
I got you. Your phone line's breaking up, but I think we get the point. Alex, Chris wondering, how long will it take before we have enough good, solid data on a decriminalization measure like that in Oregon to know what impact it's having?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly we're talking at least a few years before you're probably going to get some of the kinds of robust studies that could compare outcomes in Oregon, in general, and Portland in particular, to other states, other cities. I do think, as things stand currently, I think the data is telling us and the results are telling us that, for example, overdose deaths have increased in Oregon, but not out of the norm to what's gone on across the country. And so I think, you know, it's certainly not a case where you can, and I've seen some news articles recently kind of paint pictures of Portland and say, you know, there's all these terrible things happening because of Measure 110. But again, these kinds of things, unfortunately, particularly with respect to drug overdoses, are happening nationwide. And so you could go to, you know, any city, any state in the country, and you could paint the picture, you know, terribly. It's a terrible, awful thing, but you can paint the picture anywhere in the country of a rise in overdose deaths. And so it's, you know, we know that is the unfortunate reality. We also do know that in Oregon, there has been increases in funding for harm reduction services for treatment as a result of Measure 110. What we, you know, are probably not going to know for a few years is going to be, you know, how we can compare the situation in Oregon to what's gone on in other states, you know, and have really robust studies that would attempt to try to measure the impact of Measure 110.
Talking to Alex Kreid, who researches addiction law and policy about a decriminalization of drugs in Oregon and elsewhere around the world. David joins us now in Grand Marsh. David, hi.
Hey, how's it going? Hey, really like the topic. Unfortunately, this topic strikes really close to home in my family. And I just think that this country needs to just get away from, you know, the incarceration of people and redeveloping and redistributing, you know, the economics of it to get people the assistance they need to, you know, get back on track and to get back into society and to contribute. And I really think that that we're headed in the right direction when we have these kinds of conversations.
David, thanks a lot for the call. David mentions the economics of this, Alex, and I want to come back to something you mentioned earlier, how in a lot of communities where housing costs are very high, homelessness, in part because of that, is going up. How much is our drug and addiction problem tangled up with homelessness in a lot of our communities?
I think that there's an element to that, and I think there's also sort of more broadly an element to a lack of healthcare access, a lack of access to social services. I mean, if we compare U.S. Overdose rates and substance use disorder issues with sort of peer countries in the European Union, you know, the United States has a strikingly worse, I think, you know, in Portugal, there was roughly 7 per million residents of an overdose death rate in 2021. In the United States, it was 321 per million, which is obviously significantly more than 7 per million. And so, you know, I think that that really does go back to kind of the philosophy behind Measure 110 of we want to take money that we're currently spending on incarceration and reinvest that money, and not just incarceration, but arrest enforcement, reinvest that money in access to treatment and harm reduction services. But I think that one of the, you know, criticisms of 110 might be there needs to be more investment, you know, and I don't know to what extent that would necessarily be something that is a problem with Measure 110 specifically versus a criticism of how we approach these issues in general. One thing I do think, though, that is, you know, well worth keeping in mind, while I think the jury is still out on what the impact of Measure 110 is, I think we do have a lot of good data and history. We've had a long history of criminalizing substance use and criminalizing simple possession, and we really don't have data showing that succeeds in addressing substance use disorder. So whether 110 specifically has, you know, succeeds, what its impact is, I do think we have a lot of data that tells us criminalizing use has not worked. And so we can see why Oregon voters, you know, explored and supported this alternative in 2010. We'll see, you know, I think in the coming years, more data on what the results are of it.
Alex, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Alex Kreit, Director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy, Assistant Professor at the Northern Kentucky University School of Law. He talked to us about Oregon's Measure 110, which decriminalized all drugs a couple years back. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.